Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. Would like to thank all of you, whenever you're listening, however you're listening, wherever you're listening to us. It's always a pleasure to have you. 2014, we are kicking off a great year already. Check everything that we have here on the radio show by going to blogtalkradio.com/suspensemagazine. Or, of course, you can go to suspensemagazine.com. to find out a lot more information about what we have today's show. We got four great authors on for you today. First up is going to be Libby Hellman, followed by TJ O'Connor, Dan O'Brien, and Esther Latrulle. So we're going to have a nice, eclectic, different forms of genres coming in from the suspense mystery thriller area, and it all starts on Suspense Radio, 2 hours, right now. To another two-hour episode of Suspense Radio we have going on for you. We would like to go ahead right now and introduce our first guest. She is the author of the book Havana Lost, which came out in September. We are able to get her on the show now. We are a little bit packed, but it's good we're able to have her on the show here in January. And we want to welcome her to the show. So, Libby, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, again, so your book came out in September, Havana Lost, and so it's great to be able to have you kind of on now because now you've had a little bit to, you know, kind of get a little bit of the reviews in, a little bit of what the people have been able to say because it has been out a little over 3 or so months. But for people who are not really sure about, you know, who you are as an author, about what the book is about, give us, you know, kind of the inside look inside Havana Lost.
Havana Lost is my 10th book, and it is probably my most ambitious thriller to date because it's really in three different parts, and each part is a different generation. It follows a mafia family, in particular a mafia princess who's 18 when the story begins and in her 70s when the story ends. So we go through a lot of her life. It begins in 1958 during the Cuban Revolution that brought Fidel Castro to power. And Frankie is 18 years old at the time. She's kind of willful. She's idealistic. She's ready to take some chances. Her father wants to send her back to the United States because things are getting kind of dangerous in Havana. But instead she meets a rebel who's fighting with Fidel, falls in love, and runs away with him. So that's sort of the beginning.
And now, you know, of course, Cuba was always one of those mysterious places when I was growing up, you know, in the 60s, Cuban Missile Crisis, the whole thing going on. And now, not until really recently, are you able to sort of be able to go into Cuba and over and to see the mysteries of that fabulous city that I've heard wonderful things about. And it's just a shame that we're able to not, you know, open up borders and be able to go in there. How was it for you to be able to kind of, you know, research, get involved, the characters and the people, to better bring Cuba to life, you know, to the American kind of
right.
reader, who it is really quite a mystery to?
Well, it is, and that's kind of why I chose Cuba to write about, because everything that you said is exactly the way I felt and what I thought when I was growing up. I mean, it was this mysterious place, but it was only 90 miles from Florida. And first, it was a mecca for gambling, and I remember when I was a little girl, I'm originally from the East Coast, my parents used to fly down to Havana and gamble. And I remember being a little kid and saying, oh, well, take me with you. It's a foreign country. And, of course, they didn't. But then Fidel Castro came to power, and he was communist, and communism was our enemy, and maybe he had something to do with the Kennedy assassination. Maybe he didn't. And then before that, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and before that, the Bay of Pigs. So Cuba was this place that been accessible to us, and then that access was taken away. Well, my daughter and I were lucky enough to go back in 2012, because you can go now legally, and it was an amazing experience. First of all, it was in some ways like going into the past. They still have all the cars that roam the streets, the Chevys and the Buicks and the Fords and the old 1950s cars with the big fins and the huge engines and horsepower, and I have no idea how they keep those things running because they don't have parts.
Right.
And, you would look up and there would be a tangle of electrical wires just like you used to see when you were a kid here in the States, and probably why the Cuban phone system doesn't work as well as it should. You see buses and trolleys and things. It's an amazing experience. And I'm really, really glad I went. I felt very much at home. And a lot of that was probably because of Cuba's heritage as being kind of an outpost of the United States for so long. But it was a very familiar feeling when we got there. And that surprised me. I didn't expect to feel so comfortable there. And it's a beautiful place. A beautiful place full of mystery, full of all sorts of things. It's hard to believe that we have such problems with the island still, or some people in this country do. But anyway, the other part of what really made me want to explore Havana Lost was the mafia's influence. I mean, I've always been fascinated by the mafia. I lived in New York for a while, and the Five Families were very much on my mind. And, you know, I watched The Godfather about 20 times, and there was this
I think
one,
we all did.
Yeah, there's this one scene I think everybody remembers in Godfather Part 2 where Lee Strasberg and Al Pacino are on a roof, supposedly in Havana. They're eating birthday cake for somebody's birthday. But, Lee Strasberg, who is playing the role of Meyer Lansky, wants Michael to invest with him in Cuba. And he says, he spreads his arms and he says, we're going to own this island. And then Michael, Al Pacino, leaves and he sees a rebel who's willing to die because of the revolution, for the revolution. He's killed by some military soldiers. And he realizes this is not the place to invest. And that just gave me chills. And I knew that I wanted to combine both the pursuit of understanding Cuba with writing a mafia book, which I had not done. So that's
and yeah, and that's and that's the one thing I was gonna ask too. It is, you are kind of stepping out of something that you've not done before, with mafia, and of course you kind of did two things that you haven't done, Cuba. Brand new, mafia brand new. What made you decide that this would be the perfect time to kind of explore that side of yourself as an author?
Well, I have always liked a challenge, and after a while, I don't like doing the same thing, and I have always kind of challenged myself to try something new. My first four books were amateur sleuth mysteries, and while I love my character, and in fact, I'm going to be writing a fifth one in the not-too-distant future, I wanted... It was hard. It was hard to write amateur sleuth. You needed a really compelling reason for her to get involved in tripping over a dead body. And so I started writing a PI series, with a tough female PI, and I wrote three books with her, and I love her, and I've just finished the fourth one, which will come out later this year. But then I started to get restless again. I've always been a history buff. I majored in history in college. And, you know, but the main thing was that, you know, they tell us in fiction you have to have conflict on every page, even if it's only a character wanting a glass of water that he can't get. So I tend to do things in extremes anyway. And I start to think, well, what is the most extreme conflict I could imagine? And it was revolution, an internal revolution that upsets not only an individual, a family, a neighborhood, a community, a country, a culture, sometimes the rest of the world. I can't imagine a more extreme conflict than that. And then to set ordinary people within that situation and see how they would react, well, that just was a very exquisite puzzle that I had to solve. I had to do it. And actually, John, that is the third of what I am now calling my Revolution Trilogy. I have two other books that are set in times of extreme conflict. The one right before Havana Lost was A Bitter Veil, and it's about a young girl who marries an Iranian boy in Chicago, and then they move to Tehran. But the only problem is that 4 months after they get there, the Shah is deposed. And Ayatollah Khomeini starts in with the Islamic Republic. And the one before that was sort of my tribute to the late 60s in Chicago. There's a whole chunk of the book, the whole middle section of the book goes back to the Democratic National Convention and follows the lives of six young people who meet in that oh-so-casual way we had back then and decide to live together. So in a way, I have written those three books, and that took me way out of my comfort zone, all three of them. But I'm glad I did it. I my curiosity was sated, and they seem to be doing well. So now I'm going back to my series until I get the next brainstorm.
Yeah, you know, and it, when you kind of explain, it almost reminds me that fans of, like, an Eric Larson would get involved in kind of the books that you you just described, because that's kind of what he liked to do in those kinds of things. And I'm
yes.
sure you probably know Eric Larson. And,
yes,
and that makes it very,
great.
You know, yeah, and, you know, you're taking those, you know, real life things that happen, and you're kind of rolling those kinds of fictional things up within it. And sometimes you kind of get lost as an author yourself of what's real, what's fiction. You almost kind of lose track of that when you're writing.
I know, but I try very, very hard to make it as accurate as I possibly can. And I not only read an enormous amount before I even start writing, but I have people who are either from that part of the world or know it well fact-checked everything before it ever goes into print. So I'm trying to be very careful. I'm sure there's something that has slipped through the cracks in all three of them, except for the one in the 60s, because I did live through that myself. Now I'm dating myself. Forget it. I didn't live that. I'm not. That's not me. Anyway.
So I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Libby Hellman, and you can find more out at Libby Hellman, HELLMANN.com, of course, for Havana Lost, the book here, but then all of your, you know, the other series and the other stuff that you wrote. But
yeah,
now let's talk about, you know, you know, your main character here is an 18-year-old, Francesca Pasolini, I'm going to say, but that could be wrong.
Pacelli.
So why is she the perfect person to be in Havana Lost? What made her that person, that perfect, you know, person to head, you know, to basically star in your book?
Well, that's a really interesting question, John. And the reason that I chose her was because I knew from the beginning, and I don't usually know the endings of the books before I start them, but in this case, I knew the ending, and I knew it was going to be kind of noir. In A Bitter Veil, for example, on the other hand, Anna goes through hell in Iran, but she's a good, noble, kind of a heroine, and you want to root for her because she does all the right things and she has all the right qualities. With Frankie, not so much. You know, Frankie comes from a family that cuts corners, that uses violence to get what they want, that and usually they get it. And although she's idealistic and naive and a little, you know, immature at the beginning of the book, the question is she going to change? Is she going to escape the pull of the family heritage or not? And as we watch her in the three parts of the book, you find out the answer. And because I've already said it's kind of noir, you can imagine what it is. So it's kind of the mirror image to A Bitter Veil, but more noir. So that's what attracted me to Frankie. She's not perfect. She's seriously flawed. She's not a hero, but she's fascinating.
Well, and that's the one good thing, you know, when, I guess if you want to say flawed, they're very, you know, characters always have to be conflicted in some way. And I think that that's one of the things that, you know, you were able to kind of do. Because I think that better relates to the audience, right? I mean, you would think, you know, the audience, you know, no one's perfect in the audience. And you would think that that would be a good thing for, you know, them to get. You know, they need conflict.
They definitely need conflict. And, you know, it's interesting. Some of the comments that I've gotten, some of the people say, oh, you know, we're so disappointed. We wanted Frankie to do it a different way, but she couldn't. She couldn't. She was the way she was. And don't forget that every flawed character in fiction thinks they're a hero in their own mind. And Frankie was convinced she was doing the right things for her family and for the future of the family and for whatever other reasons. It just doesn't come through that way to the rest of the world. We may not agree that Frankie was doing the right thing. And so we see the conflict, or we have conflict because we see her doing things of which we do not necessarily approve. But she had to. I mean, that is the way she was. The interesting thing is more people have asked me, you know, is there going to be a sequel? And I really hadn't thought about it. I thought I had said pretty much everything I wanted to say. But you never know. We'll see. Maybe.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, true. I mean, if you had her in front of you, if you had Francesca sitting in front of you right now, what would be one of the one things that, you know, you would want to know? What, I mean, do you want to explore her further? Is there anything coming on the horizon? Is there, you know, how in-depth and, you know, how in-depth is she into you, into the reader?
Well, that's a really interesting question. She has a granddaughter now, and her granddaughter is in her early 20s, so her granddaughter, we end the book where Frankie began, you know, as a 21-year, you know, in her late teens or early 20s. And the question that I would have is, what's going to happen to the granddaughter? Where is her travel? Where's her journey as a woman going to take her? Is she going to be more like Frankie, with whom she has or had a very close relationship? Is Frankie going to take her by the hand and say, because her own son, Luis's mother, Frankie's son, is not around, and I can't really tell you more than that because it's a spoiler. But anyway, the granddaughter is there. And is Frankie going to take her in hand, or is Luisa going to break the family tradition and do something completely different? So that's I think, the question that people had at the end of the book, because I did leave it a little bit open-ended. I mean, you know, you can't tie up everything.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to have War and Peace if you try to tie everything up 1,500 pages. I guess that's why maybe people write trilogies, too, you know, or things of that nature, that they can kind of explore and tie those things up, which is another reason why I always say TV is a much better way to get involved with character development than a movie. Movie's 2 hours. TV could be one season is 24 hours. You're going to get a lot more in-depth in the character that way.
I absolutely agree, and Homeland was a great example of that. Damian Lewis and Claire Danes did a really good job with the character development there, I think. I mean, I'm a Homeland junkie, what can I say? Anyway, that Havana Lost, we've been talking about women and strong women, and they are definitely a hallmark of my fiction, but I do want to say that I try to write interesting men as well, and there are probably more men in Havana Lost than women who are playing important roles, because that's what it was like back then. And there's a fairly high body count in Havana Lost also.
You got to have a little bit of a body count.
Oh, well, this one, there's plenty.
Yeah. That's
more,
good.
More than my typical book.
And so you brought up the question, or you brought up the men aspect of your book. So which man would you say, or character in the book, gave you probably the biggest surprise of having a larger voice than you originally thought they would when you first started writing Havana Lost?
No question. That's easy. Luis is the name of the young rebel that Francesca falls in love with. His best friend's name is Raul. And Raul ended up being a much larger part of the book than I had thought. He's in all three parts of the book, unlike Luis. And so he's there all the way through. And he surprised me. He was, I expected him just to sort of be a sidekick and a minor character, but he ended up being a fairly major character. So, yeah. He's Cuban. He's not terribly well-educated. He's much more into doing than thinking. And he makes somewhat impulsive decisions that then he has to bear the consequences of, sometimes years later.
Now, the one thing that you also talked about off the air right before we came on was there's something going on, I guess, through Monday with Havana Lost. So if anybody's listening and they catch the show up and through Monday, what is that happening? What do you have going on with the book?
In conjunction with this interview, just because I lowered the price of Havana Lost, and it's 99 cents today, Saturday, which is the day we're recording this, and then for 2 days after that, it will be $1.99, and for 2 days after that, it will be $2.99 as opposed to its normal price of $4. So I hope people might take advantage of it.
Right. So anybody listening, and again, a lot of people listen to this on demand, so if that's when you're listening to it, but you're within that time frame, go out to Amazon, go out to Apple iBooks, wherever you tend to buy them, and you can find the book, you know, on sale now. And that's the one good thing. Also, people still kind of push back on the whole Kindle and the iBooks or in the electronic books. And
right.
I love them. I think
I love them too.
You know, I hate cell phone technology, but I love ebook technology.
Yeah, I love it too. And do not fear. I have a paperback, and the paperback is widely available.
Right.
And so people can go to their bookstores and ask for it. And it's also in audio. And you can find the audio.
Oh,
it's
good.
Widely available wherever you get your audio books from. And that was just so much fun because I had a male and a female voice do the audio, narrate the audio, and I think it turned out really nicely.
So we have a couple, 2-3 minutes left here.
Mm-hmm.
Give everybody a little bit about, okay, where you'd be, or I mean, a good way to contact you, what other stuff you may have coming up in the future, or stuff that you had, you know, in the past, just to give them more of an idea of everybody who's listening about who is Libby Hellman and what you have going on.
Well, wow. I have a short story coming out in March in an anthology that has been put together by Chris Rush and Dean Wesley Smith. And my short story is called No Good Deed, and it is set in a prison in Indiana in the 60s. And the prison is called Pendleton, and it had the honor of being the, quote, worst prison in the United States, according to LBJ, who made a big, who had a speech about it and when he was talking about prison reform back in the 60s. And, by the way, another
Where's that located?
Indiana.
Indiana.
Not too far from Indianapolis. And I had the help of a wonderful author named Les Edgerton, who knows the system down there pretty well, and he was very kind. And that's a pretty noir story as well. In fact, the last few things I've written have been pretty pretty dark, so much
yeah.
so that I was beginning to worry about where I was going. I mean, you know, they do say that authors become darker as they keep writing, and that's what was happening to me. So I did write another Georgia Davis book. She's my PI that I mentioned way back at the beginning. And I think I'm going to call that Comeback, and that should be out later this year. And that's pretty dark as well. But then I'm about to start writing a new Ellie Forman book. And remember, Ellie was the amateur sleuth that I talked about at the beginning. She's a video producer and a single mother. And I have a great story that involves corporate espionage that I'm going to start writing. So Ellie has a sense of humor, so it's like pulling me back from the really, really dark stuff, but it's still going to be a lot of suspense. I'm very excited about it. And I'm about to start that probably sometime in the next few weeks. So all of my books are available in paperback and audio and e-books. I also have a collection of 20 short stories, which is called Nice Girl Does Noir, and that's available in paperback and audio as well as ebook. And people are more than happy to contact me through my website. I'm pretty active on my Facebook page and also Google+. So I'm out there. I'm definitely
out
there.
Well, you know, that's what it takes today, Libby. You got to be out there. You got to be everywhere. And I think it's exciting. And, you know, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing just a little bit about you, because we really didn't know too much about you. So it was great to be able to catch up with you and everything that you got going on.
Great. Thank you so much, John. It's been fun.
All right. You have a good one. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
So, again, everybody, that is author Libby Hellman, and the book is called Havana Lost. You can go to LibbyHellman.com for a lot more information. Speaking of great books, like always, we have a couple great books coming out. Our friend, New York Times bestselling author Jan Burke, who is also the host of Crime and Science Radio with Doug Weil on Suspense Radio. You can hear all the shows that they have. She returns with her book, Caught Red-Handed, which is an e-short story collection featuring a brand-new Irene Kelly short story. Before Frank Harriman and Irene Kelly got married, Frank was a rookie cop in Bakersfield, California. When he investigates one of the worst types of calls a policeman can get, a bad smell coming from a closed trailer on a hot day, Frank and his training officer are not surprised to find a dead body. But everyone is stunned when the corp leads them to the police chief's downfall, and you got to check out Caught Red-Handed today. It's $1.99. You can check it out on Amazon. It's going to come out in February. And again, that is from New York Times bestselling author Jan Burke, who's also the host of Crime and Science Radio right here on Suspense Radio. And we are going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with our next guest, TJ O'Connor, and his stuff that's going on. And until then, you have the great pleasure of listening to this. So I want to welcome you all back here for the next segment here in Suspense Radio. I want to again thank Libby for coming on and talking with her book. But now we are going to transition into our next author. He is the author of Dying to Know. His name is T.J. O'Connor. And T.J., we want to thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, John. How are you? And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about my book.
Hey, we're doing great out here. I can't complain. Things are going really well. And it's always great to be able to talk to great authors like yourself and, give more people find new authors and new books to read. That's what we're kind of all about here. So why don't you give us a little bit about Dying to Know and, what the book's about and anything else you want to kind of reveal to us?
Sure, I'd love to. First of all, Dying to Know is my first published work. It was bought up with a series by Midnight Inc., which specializes in mysteries and suspense. And it's the story of a detective out of local Winchester, Virginia, a beautiful historic town in northwestern Virginia. And the story cracks where the detective, Oliver Tucker, is killed and comes back to help his wife and former partner not only solve his murder, but also solve a series of murders that have historically been plaguing the town. So each of the books has a backdrop of current murder. It has a historical twist to it, in this case, a twist back to the Civil War. And then there's also a small paranormal element to it. And it's probably important to point out that this is not a ghost story. It's not really intended to be a ghost story, although some folks have read it and kind of see it that way. It's really a traditional murder mystery with a paranormal twist that allows the characters to do things a little out of the ordinary. It gives them a perspective to solving the mystery that's a little unique. So that's the first one starts in Winchester. The second will come out. It's called Dying for the Past. It'll be out January this time next year. And then the third sequel we're working on right now, I'm in the middle of writing it. It'll come out a year later, and that's tentatively titled Dying to Tell. And similar plot lines, it'll always have a historical perspective, a traditional murder mystery, and a little bit of a paranormal twist to it.
So your character, Detective Oliver Tucker, he's the he's the head of your, he's the mainstay of your books here. He's going to be the one that's going to go forward with you in the series. So give us some of his background. Who is he? What is he? What makes him so special? What makes him the person that is great for to be the spearheaded, the front man, basically, for your series?
Well, that's really an interesting question, too, because I've been fleshing that out in the first couple books. As it turns out, I originally started this book out to be a standalone. I didn't know that it would make a great series. I'm kind of a rookie at this. But what it ends up being after the first novel is that Oliver Tucker is, he was orphaned as a child. He never knew his parents. He became a police officer and then worked his way up to be a homicide detective in the small community. He's, he's very much a typical cop. He's sarcastic. He's adventurous. He's good-hearted, but he has a different take on the world. He tries not to take things too awful serious. And then when he's killed and he comes back, he starts to learn that this is not necessarily by chance. It wasn't a chance murder. It was a premeditated murder for other reasons, including, as I said, the historical spin that comes with the story. And then as the series will progress, we'll learn more and more about Tuck's history, where his what his family was about, and why it is that Tuck coming back as a detective and a spirit is not unusual for his family. You'll learn more about what his family roots are historically in the Winchester and Virginia communities. And we'll find out a little bit about other parts of his family, where he comes from a long line of adventurers from the OSS operatives of World War II through the intelligence community of the modern day. So Tuck is a little bit unique in the first book, and the readers will find out connections are to the present, why there's a haunting, if you will, element to the story about the past, where other murders and historical plots have taken place that he ends up being connected to. And then as the series progresses with Dying for the Past and Dying to Tell, and hopefully if the readers like it, we'll get some more books out there, you'll learn more about his family and how each one of them now begins slowly to interact in Tuck's investigations, and his past and future kind of collide, at the same time. And one of the things I've had a lot of fun with in the stories about his past is that unlike traditional murder mysteries where, you know, you have certain character development, you have to have twists and turns, and it's mysteries are more cerebral than they are action-packed. Well, when you throw in, you know, a paranormal flaw, if you will, to the main character, he's not any longer tied down to search warrants and probable cause and all those things. It really doesn't have an impact whatsoever. So what it ends up being is he has all these new capabilities that will come out. For instance, he can be present for a conversation and overhear suspects and witnesses and things like that. So there's a different twist to it. And as we progress through the series, you'll see where his ancestors and his family background is not so mysterious. And it ends up playing a very key role in the future books that I'll be writing.
Now, when you sat down and decided, okay, this is what I want to start writing, and this is the genre that I want to start writing in, was Oliver kind of on the brain first, or was it, okay, this is what I want to write, but I got a good premise together, now I got to get characters together? You know,
You know, that's another great question because, you know, I'm glad my daughter isn't here because she'd be slapping me behind the head right now. This book was a fluke, actually. I've written three thrillers before Dying to Know. My world is in counterintelligence and anti-terrorism and investigation. So I was writing, you know, what I knew, and I hadn't been published yet. So I happened to be telling my adult daughter one day about this nightmare that has plagued me since the 1980s. And the nightmare was that I was killed during an operation and came back to solve, you know, my killing and find the persons responsible. Well, I was telling my daughter about this, and she was a big movie buff. She's a big mystery buff. And she said, you know, that would make a great story. And I wasn't real sure about that at first. And it was, you know, okay, great, you know, great, Gene, that would be wonderful. But she said, no, really, on TV there are all kinds of ghost shows and there are all kinds of, you know, paranormal things that's coming back. There's Dark Shadows is back out, and there's, you know, vampire detectives. You should write this. Well, by chance, I said, all right, fine. You know, I'll write a book, and I'll do it for my daughter. And I sat down, and I wrote Dying to Know. And I was really pleased with the way it came out. And Oliver Tucker kind of rose up from, you know, kind of an amalgamation, if you will, of real people that I've known over the years, some really wonderful people from my past when I was an OSI agent all the way through, you know, consulting practices and things. But, of course, there's a lot of me in it, because I think any writer that says they're not somewhere in the book is probably not being, you know, completely honest. And, you know, he kind of came out as fun-loving. He's got, this handicap that he's actually a dead detective. And it came together really, really well for me, and I was very pleased with it. And when I presented it to the agents, I was looking for, a literary agent. The third one I sent it to, Kimberly Cameron in California, scooped it up. She saw a connection to the old 1940s Topper and the Thin Man movie series, and off we went from there. And I was really pleased that somebody kind of understood what I was doing with Oliver Tucker. But it was an accident, and quite frankly, had my daughter not suggested I write it, I would have been still writing thrillers. But I'm completely, completely pleased to be writing murder mysteries right now.
So did you cut her into some of the royalties?
Well, John, you know, for a beginning writer, there really aren't any royalties yet. You know, I think...
Well, you could take
it
to McDonald's or something, get your first royalty check to McDonald's or something,
They make out very well. I've got five super adult children, and they do okay. But, you know, she's one of my readers. I've got a team of readers, a couple of my daughters and a couple of their friends, and they're very active, involved in reading my material and telling me when, you know, the old man's crazy. And they do a great job. And, you know, certainly they're all into public service. And this thing was a way for her to help me out. And, you know, hopefully maybe one day she'll go down the similar path because she's got some talent too.
Well, just sitting here thinking, I just had a question that I've never really asked before, but it just kind of came to my head since, basically, your daughters are in the younger generation, the generation that's going to be growing up with electronic books, with Kindle books, with all of this technology in their hands, you know, more than what we had while we were growing up. I was growing up when I had the Atari 2600 came out when I was, I think, 10 years old, 11 years old.
Yeah,
you know,
I remember.
With the, uh, with, play with the little squares and nothing else. So my question is now, when everything is so, and you're a new author in this age, so now that everything is so quick, which means your book goes out, bam, you see a review on Amazon. Never used to happen that way. Bam, you see people talking about it on Facebook. Are you going to let that kind of influence your next books, because now you have an idea of maybe what people are interested in, what they talk about, what makes them, why maybe they buy a certain book or why they gravitate to a certain author? Are you using all that as kind of information and making it influential in your writing and your career going forward?
You know, the answer is yes and no to a certain degree. I mean, I will write the stories that I think I'm able to write. You know, I'm going to be writing these murder mysteries like Dying to Know, and I'll be writing some other thrillers. My agent's got a couple she's about ready to present to the market. But so the no part is I will continue to write what I like to write and what my publisher and my agent think is a good plan for me. But I also am to some degree influenced by the marketplace in that, you know, if these types of stories catch on, if it becomes, you know, a very viable place for me to be, I'll probably spend more time there than I might to go back and do some thriller writing. But I do watch, you know, what Amazon's doing. I've got a very good friend of mine, New York Times bestselling writer, Stephen Fry, who writes for Amazon now. And, you know, I've learned a lot from the people like Steve who talk about what the marketplace is doing and, you know, thinks they really know what the market's doing. I would love to get their business card because I don't know if anybody's real sure. And but, you know, you watch what's out there selling. You know, you look at the ads. You look what other authors are doing. It absolutely influences me because I'm so new to it. I'm still trying to absorb as much as I can and learn. But at the end of the day, I still have to trust, you know, my own instincts. I have to trust my agent, you know, the wonderful Kimberly Cameron, and Midnight Ink Publishers. You know, I really want to pay attention to the directions they're taking me because they're the pros. And, you know, I need to listen to them as much as I can.
And again, I want to remind everybody we're speaking here with author T.J. O'Connor. Go to tjoconnor.com for more information on his series and, of course, this book, Dying to Know. Well, we have a lot of authors that listen to the show. Of course, a lot of authors who want to be published authors that listen to the show. And they all love to hear the same thing, kind of your journey. What were you going through, and what have you learned now that you are in this crazy business? I don't know if that's a curse or a blessing, but you're in it, and now you're here. So what have you learned? What can you kind of say how your journey's been going and what you're doing now? Because I know that you took a little time away. You're at a book signing right now, so that's something that you're doing. What else? What piece of advice are you taking with you? Anything?
Well, you know, I tell you what. Again, I'm a rookie at this. I've written 7 novels. This is the first book to come out. It's the middle of the pack. It's book number 4. So I'm relearning some things. I thought I knew what was going on when I got an agent, and I had to relearn a little bit. A lot of the things I'm learning are the things that probably are the most uncomfortable for me, you know, and that is I've spent 35 years in investigations and anti-terrorism, and, you know, those are the kind of people that really don't go out and, you know, do book signings, and they don't come out and they don't like to do interviews, they don't write blogs. You know, you kind of stay behind the scenes. Now it's a whole different world for me. I have to learn to get out there. I had to go Facebook for the first time, and I had to learn all this PR that I had to get involved with. It was totally contrary to my nature. And, you know, that was the hardest part, was learning to kind of sell myself and be willing to talk about things that in the past I just wasn't going to do. So that was the first hurdle, and I'm still kind of learning that. But, you know, the nice thing about my situation is that I do know some, you know, really great writers. I've come to know, since joining Midnight Ink, there's a great author circle I belong to and some really great people there. And so we talk, you know, we help each other out. You know, you listen a lot. And, you know, as a 35-year investigator and intelligence guy, listening and learning is second nature. You're always listening for good hints. And there's just some good information you get from these folks. The other kind of new things that I'm doing is I'm having the balanced time that is probably keeping me from being able to write, you know, constantly. I work, you know, more than a full-time job, you know, just to pay the bills like everybody else and, you know, make the mortgage payment. And then, you know, there's writing, but I've got, you know, a family, I've got other commitments, but I force that time in. Writing is the way I relax. It's the way I try to maintain some degree of sanity, although my wife and kids would probably think I was failing in that. You know, it's a way to keep things moving, but finding time to balance all this stuff is something I'm having to relearn because, you know, it's 20 hours a day I'm going now, and you can't sustain that, right? So you have to make sure that the quality of your work doesn't get less, and you have to make sure you meet your commitments. But, you know, I see this as a new opportunity. I don't know that it would ever be a career. It depends on the fans. If people like the books enough, then I can make a living, terrific. But, you know, you don't plan on that. You plan on
right.
having a great run, writing a bunch of books, and having some fans and having fun. And that's really what I'm looking at right now.
You know, and I think that that's a nice, fresh approach because I think too many people are living in this American Idol reality world dream where they think that they should – They think that, oh, I'm published. That means I'm going to make $1 million a year. Or now I'm on TV, so I should be famous. And I think that we're getting too caught up in that. Instead of writing for just the literature and the fun of it and whatever happens, happens. And I always say that if you're the best at something, I don't care if you're the best at making shoelaces, you are going to, you know, you'll make money at it. You'll be able to do what you want to do with it. So I do find that as a nice, fresh approach.
You know, absolutely. But, you know, the reality of it is, you know, there's I've got two types of people around me right now. You know, my family who think, oh, you wrote a book, you've sold three books, maybe you're going to sell a couple more this year. You're on your way. And I keep saying, everybody slow down. You know, this is a long-term game. It's not a short-term game. Certainly there are the
right.
John Grishams of the world. There are, you know, some of these fabulous writers like Nelson DeMille who are making, you know, a good living, you know, super great job. But, you know, Like everything
but you know
else,
what's funny about all those
1%?
Authors that you mentioned? You know what's funny when people mention those authors, Lee Child, Nelson DeMille, John Grisham, all those authors came out before the industry changed, and while publishers were able to control the supply of the books to the marketplace. But now that is no longer the case, I'm curious to see what authors break out now in this generation compared to the ones that already had the following, and now they're just basically moving their following over. That's what I want to see. That's what I want to know.
That's a real interesting point because, as I mentioned, Stephen Fry he's written 18 bestsellers, and he was a traditional publisher. And, you know,
right.
he did so super well. And then now he's moved over to Amazon, and I won't put words in his mouth, but, you know, at the end of the day, he sees the market trend. He's a brilliant financier. And, you know, he sees this trend, and he's trying to get ahead of it. But at the same time, you know, I talk to people all the time that are in self-publishing, and some of them are doing very well and some aren't. And there's so many different ways to publish right now. You know, I don't know which the best place to be. I don't know where the place is to be in 5 years. I know that what I want to do is, you know, listen to the people that know, like my agent and Midnight Inc., and try to get myself just writing good books so that wherever they buy them, whether it's on the Internet or a used bookstore or, you know, brick-and-mortar, bookstore, that they'll find me because they want to read what I've written, not because it's the right medium.
Right. Right. And I think, and even if you're 5 years down the way, there's still only the basic qualities of publishing is still there. The author has to write great books. The publisher has to edit it and distribute it. That will never change. It will never change to the fact of the electronic part, it's not going to – the only thing that can really be added is the author going to be on a video camera reading his book? Well, we know that's never going to happen because no one's going to sit there watching a 24-hour show looking at an author reading a book. And that ain't going to happen.
Right.
So the only other way to do it is you might have more audiobooks, but the delivery system of how electronic books is moving is really probably this is what's going to be for the time to come. I can't think of anything that could possibly be any different as a delivery system for the written word besides what we have right now. Now it's just going to be a matter of how can you find more fans in order to have them read your book. I think that's the biggest problem because now the supply has far outlasted the demand. We need more readers. We don't need, you know, that's the one thing we need is we need more readers. We need to get people more excited about the genre. And then I think it'll
be better.
You
know, I think you're right about the readers. You know, I keep hearing from people that less people are reading books. I'm not sure that's true. I don't know for
I don't think that's true.
I think the fact of the matter is people are getting their their literature and their novels and their nonfictions different. And I'm not even sure it's an age thing anymore. I know the young people go to the Internet. I know they're into downloading books and Kindles and all that. I know some of the older people are still into brick-and-mortar bookstores and things like that. And, you know, I think the way forward is to figure out what demographic you're writing for and bring people to you wherever you are. And I think in my case, because I'm new, I need to touch a little bit of everywhere that I possibly can. But I think you've made a really good point about the delivery system's important, because what used to be the public relations machine for getting your name out and everything is completely different now. You know, here I am talking via cell phone from a bookstore to you, you know, in this,
right.
this great radio program. So I'm hitting two mediums today all at once. I've introduced myself to Facebook and websites and all that, and I've got a great PR lady that I've hired to help me with the publicity, and she's got an entirely different spin. So, you know, there are three or four different things I'm trying all at once just to figure out, you know, the old thing, throw it against the wall, see what sticks. And in this case, it's try all these different delivery mechanisms, try to find out how to get my name out, and figure out where are the people that want to hear from me, and then kind of focus more energy there, and then find other ways to reach them in other mediums.
Yeah, I agree 100% with everything that you're saying, and that's going to be the fun part going forward. And the other fun part going forward, and you mentioned a little bit about where you're going to be in the future, or how your writing is going to be in the future, and that's so you know for sure that right now three books are going to be written in the series, and that's what you have for sure. We don't know beyond that, correct?
No, that's right. Midnight Inc. bought Dying to Know plus two sequels. I've got three other books written and ready to present when the time is right. I leave that up to my agent, Kimberly Cameron. She has got another book right now about to go to the market, of course, starting with Midnight Inc., because that's the way you do it. And that's called New Sins for Old Scores, which is also a murder mystery with a paranormal twist. And it takes place in Northern Virginia with a detective who is disgraced in the beginning over the murder of his partner. But he is also assisted by the spirit of a former OSS operative. And it's a similar concept, and it's a traditional murder mystery with a paranormal twist and a historical plot, but different characters. It takes a different line of theme as we go forward. And that's about to go out probably in the next month or so, I'm guessing now, that my agent will be presenting that. And I've got a couple other a little bit harder core murder mysteries that she'll be looking at very soon. And I've got probably at least between three and five thrillers that I've either penned out or partially penned out and are ready to go forward. So I've got a lot in the works. It's just a matter of timing, what the marketplace is interested in, of course, what my agent and what my publisher are interested in too.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely, you know, you're into it. You can just tell by listening to you that not only are you excited about just what you're writing, but this is something that even if you don't make a living, I can definitely tell this is something you're just going to do for quite some time, because you can just hear the enjoyment, which always makes it happy for me to be able to hear that from the author, because I think that makes for much more interesting books, because you're doing it out of the sheer joy of wanting to get your stories out to the public. And I think that that's important. And I think that that's why authors will sustain themselves longer if that's the way that they start out writing, instead of saying, hey, I want to make $1 million. Well, you know what? Then if you don't, then you're probably going to not be happy with yourself.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I hope that's the case. I know it isn't mine. I mean, like I said, I've written seven novels. I wrote four of them before I ever sold Dying to Know or even got an agent, and I wasn't quitting. And, you know, other writers that I know, both published and unpublished, are doing it because that's what they want to do. And every time they write a book, they try to get it published. And I know some that are like me who have written a half a dozen or a dozen books, and they're keeping at it. And that's not a money issue. That's not a, you know, I want to be famous issue. That's just, we love books. We love to read. You know, we love to write. And if somebody buys it one day and you make a little bit of money, terrific. But you're going to write books no matter what. And if this, you know, God forbid, if this is the only three books I ever publish, I hope that's not the case. But if it is, I'll still write books after this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, TJ, I know that you got to get back to your signing, and I don't want to keep you any longer. I really appreciate you talking to us. It's been a pleasure. Wish you nothing but more, you know, more success in the future. And keep us up to date. And when the next book comes out, maybe we'll have you on again and see how the series is going.
I would love to do that, John. And thank you very much for having me on the program. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks a lot, TJ. Enjoy yourself. We'll talk with you later.
Thank you. Take care now.
So again, everybody, that is author TJ O'Connor. The book is called Dying to Know. Go to tjoconnor.com. Find it wherever books are sold. And it sounds very fascinating. I love the idea of Oliver Tucker kind of being dead, murdered in his home, but now he returns to, you know, help himself. But now he's going to have to help others. So there's a lot of fun things that can go on in there. A little paranormal murder mystery, whodunit. One of the first, maybe not one of the first of its kind, but I'll tell you what, it sounds like a very cool premise that would fall right in line with the readers that we definitely have. So coming up is going to be our next author, but there's a little bit different here because this is going to be a lot more of an industry speaker with Dan O'Brien. He is also the head of Amalgam Publishing. He has a lot of things that are going on, author, blog. So it was great to be able to have someone also involved in the industry to give you guys a little more idea of what's going on, a little more news, a little more behind-the-scenes look. And so we're going to have Dan coming up here right after this break.
Too much to explain.
I want to welcome everybody back here to the next segment of the show, Half Over the Show. I want to thank Libby Holman and, again, we just had T.J. O'Connor on talking about their books. We are stepping now into his author, consultant, editor. He's done some things in the industry, so it's great to be able to have him on because now we're going to get some different sides of things, which is something we always like to do. His name is Dan O'Brien, and Dan, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on today. I really appreciate it.
So let's jump in first to your books, and let's look at your first book here. Let's look at the book that we're going to talk about probably, you know, fits us a little bit better. You got a predator, Cold North Minnesota Town, which is, well, first of all, he's going to be a predator because he is cold, and Minnesota, that's, he ain't got much else to do in the winter. But we talked, you know, talk a little bit about that. But it's called Bitten. Give us a little bit about it. Tell us what it's about.
Sure. There was this idea I had a while back, and it was to kind of paint supernatural creatures in a different way. And so I lived in northern Minnesota for a short time, and I thought a werewolf and a serial killer up in northern Minnesota in this tiny little town would be kind of fun. And so I kind of, that was kind of the jumping off point for the book. And I wanted to create this kind of female Sherlock Holmes character. So, you know, long story short, you know, I created the character Lauren Westlake, and she's following up these cold cases, you know, no pun intended. That kind of takes her up to northern Minnesota. And they look like serial killing, but there's clearly something out there in the woods. And the whole story kind of takes this murder mystery with that, you know, horror supernatural type of turn. She's trying to figure out what it is that's actually killing people and, you know, whether or not it's something supernatural or if it's something just really, really human.
Now, your main character kind of in here, you know, Lauren Westlake, she is FBI. Give us a little information about her. Was the book kind of surrounded by, you know, this is the idea that I want to do? Was it Lauren you wanted to kind of look a little further into? What was kind of the conceptual side that you decided that you wanted to get involved in?
Well, it kind of started out as a gift to my wife, honestly, because I generally read science fiction and fantasy, and she really wanted something horror and something with worlds in it. So that was kind of the first place I started. But then it quickly became about looking at monsters in a different way and then developing this character in Lauren. And the way the book starts out, it's more just kind of introducing the character. We're really not getting that deep interior yet. And there is a sequel coming that takes place in San Francisco because I kind of like this idea for city hopping and going different places and going after different monsters. But the development was really to look at werewolves in kind of a different way, and that's kind of how I approached it. There's always this, you know, bitten by the light of the moon type of thing, and then you slowly turn into one, and there's the metamorphosis and the genesis of the creature. And not to give away too much of a spoiler in the book for people that may actually go on and read it, but I decided really what's going on is, you know, a werewolf is just another species of animal. And their bite has this really virulent neurotoxin in it that, you know, slows down their prey generally. But when they bite a human, it interacts very differently with neurotransmitters. And when it does that, they kind of slowly go insane. So they think they're becoming some kind of monster, but they're not. They're just, it's the slow degeneration of the human brain. But they think they're becoming a werewolf. So it was kind of this weird twist I wanted to do, you know, moving forward with, you know, the classic monsters in general, but I kind of started with werewolves and kind of this cold climate and the idea of, like, seeing Bigfoot or a big bear in the woods and not really knowing, you know, knowing what it is.
Yeah, I mean, and that, you know, because you've written quite a bit of books, and this is something that, you know, you did maybe step out a little bit of your zone and did more, you know, the police procedural, more of the
sure.
kind of thing, but it still has your, you know, your feel on it. So people that read your books, and you can kind of go back and just look at, you know, some of the other ones you did, like Cerulean Dreams, the End of the World Playlist, so things like that, they still have those kinds of same sense. So you really didn't lose too much of who you are, but how was it exploring that side of you within, you know, writing something a little outside of what you're normally doing?
It was a lot of fun, and what turned out to be kind of interesting about this book in general is it's slowly become my bestseller. It's the one that I sell, you know, 10,000-15,000 copies of a year, and I keep getting people on board with it, and it surprises me, honestly, because it was meant as kind of a, you know, fun little exercise. Can I write supernatural horror? Is it something I could do and kind of come up with this, you know, fun police, you said the police procedural type character that can go somewhere, kind of develop her into something else. And it's been great. It's really interesting, and they're really fun. And I hesitate to say easy to write, but they come off really simple. I don't feel like I have to agonize over each plot detail. I kind of just, you know, go with the monster, decide how she's going to investigate it, pick up some kind of neat clues that she would have to find and kind of put together, and then build that world around her. You know, how am I going to challenge her in this book? What kind of peripheral characters am I going to have? How do they inform her? How do they inform the investigation? It's been really neat. I've always been a fan of like X-Files and Fringe, so I like the kind of police procedural with a sci-fi twinge or a horror twinge or a supernatural twinge, and it just seemed neat. It's a lot of fun. Obviously, I love what I do, and I did. Author you had on just before talked about doing it for the sake of writing, and that's the only reason why I do it at this point. I mean, it's nice to make money and make a living, but I just like to write books that people want to read. that's always kind of the goal.
Yeah, and so and the one thing that you also have going on is, aside with your books, is you also do some kind of consulting. You are also the head of Amalgam Publishing. You have a lot of other things, so you're involved in the business side. So you're kind of doing both things at once, along with writing, along with editing, along with inside the publishing. So you kind of do the whole thing. That's got to be a lot of your time. It's got to take up a lot.
It is. It's like wearing a lot of hats. And I worked at International Magazine for a little while before it went out of business. So I had this really fun experience of being behind the scenes, you know, having to go through submissions, having to set out design, having to do layout, and having to deal with writers in a way that I'd never personally dealt with them, even when I was doing freelance editing, whether with publishers or in the private sector. So it kind of informs, you know, how I can help authors publish their books, you know, how they could, you know, maybe not fall in the same pitfalls that a lot of first-time authors do. And so the consulting was kind of born out of it. But, it became a full-time endeavor. I mean, it's a 16, 18-hour day between the three things. But they come together in this really, really neat way, at least for me, that it's what I get to do. So I get to have a living writing my own books, helping people get published, and then helping people hone their craft and then market their books, because that's obviously the hardest part. 90 to 95% of being successful as an author is, you know, how do you get the word out? How do you get people to read your books? And that's one of those things. It's a trap for most authors. And so I like being there to help people through that. So it definitely became something that took over my life, but in a good way. I think it's in a good way.
Yeah, now that it has kind of taken over your life and you kind of see the craziness that publishing is, that writing is, and everything else and all that stuff is, if you know now what you knew then, would you change anything a little different?
Yeah, when I started out, I went the very super traditional route. You know, I queried every agent, I queried every publisher, you know, I lined my walls with rejection letters. I made little chairs and little origami out of them because, you know, that just happens. That's part of the course. And the publishing sphere has changed so much that it's really all on the author now to be successful at it, however you might define success. So going back, I might have spent a little more time on building my platform right out of the gate, you know, cultivating a readership and reviewers and just the social media aspect that's become so powerful. Now, obviously, it's kind of been born into that. It's moving with us now. But I might have jumped on the bandwagon of starting my own imprint a little bit earlier, having seen how self-publishing kind of took a large market share out with Kindle and CreateSpace and Lightning Source and all those. I might have started a little earlier. I kind of waited a bit and still muddled around in traditional publishing, even knowing what I knew about where it was kind of going and how I could be successful at it.
Yeah, I mean, excuse me. Yeah, that's when you start getting involved with publishing and you start getting involved with the other side, does it affect your reading? When you start doing some editing and you start seeing how other authors kind of do things or maybe how directions that they go, and then you kind of see maybe successes or not successes, do you kind of use that when you're writing and maybe like when you wrote a book called, you know, Bitten?
Absolutely, yeah. Reading other people's work, much like being a part of a writing group or just reading your stuff out loud or even hearing somebody else read it, informs your process. And just it's exactly what you said, taking in submissions, reading what other people work with, and especially sitting with people and seeing how excited they get about where their book's going or how they want to plot something out or how they want their character to develop. It makes me really sit back and appreciate how much fun it's been for me and that I get the opportunity to do this, and then how do I make myself better? Because that's what I want to do with every book. I want every book to be better than the one I put out before. I want to improve on, you know, maybe places where I didn't do as well or I could have done better. And then also, you know, try to bring something new every single time. So working with writers in all capacities, whether it's the consulting or the publishing side, absolutely changes how I write things. And it's not that I'm like, oh, I want to do that now. I like that idea. It makes me rethink how I went about a character or maybe appreciate how I went about a character when I might have just considered it mundane. It's just how I go through my process or how I go through creating a character. So working with other writers, just like being a writer's group or anything else, really, really helps you with developing yourself as a writer and learning to enjoy it. You don't feel so alone, so isolated. It gives you a better perspective.
Yeah, I would have to say that, you know, just from hearing and everything that you're doing and everything that's going on, that, you know, your passion lies within just the whole publishing, writing, and realm and how it's all been. But how did it kind of start out that way? Was it a certain book? Was it a certain thing that you did or something that made you take this path?
You know, if you would ask my parents or my family, apparently when I was about 6 or 7, I made a play for my cousin for his birthday. And I created this whole ridiculous story, and I used to be, you know, kind of artistic in the sense that I could draw. I drew all these little characters and cut them out and colored them in and put them on popsicle sticks and did a play. And so everybody in my family said, oh, someday Dan's going to do, you know, you can do writing or you can make movies. And, you know, a long time went by, and I, you know, went through graduate school and I got my degrees in psychology. And at some point in the background, the writing was always there. The idea of storytelling was always there. But really the success of Bitten is what kind of kept me going. There was a point maybe 5 or 6 years ago where I thought, you know, maybe this will be more of a hobby. It's something I'll kind of put in the background. I'll focus on something more academic. But a lot of radio show hosts, including Cyrus Webb, always try to give him a shout-out. He brought me on the show when I was a nobody, and he helped me sell a lot of books, and he's one of the biggest champions of Bitten, specifically, and he's always on me about putting sequels out because he wants to know what's going to happen. But really, the fact that I could write something that people would enjoy that I hadn't anticipated. It wasn't a cerebral book. It wasn't something where I was trying to get across any kind of message. It was just fun. So the fact that I could write something fun and it could turn into something really made me think, wow, I want to do this and I want to help other people do this.
What exactly then is Amalgam Publishing? What are you, you know, what do you do? What are you looking for? What was the, you know, I guess the conceptualism behind, you know, why you started this and what you're hoping to gain going forward?
So Amalgam for me really became about regional and community publishing. That magazine that I worked at, we worked up here in Northern California, and they wanted desperately to be an international magazine. They wanted to compete with Harper's and Atlantic and New Yorker. And part of me always thought, you know, what would really, really work is if there was just regionally specific anthologies, regionally specific collections that highlighted great writers in any particular place. And so from that, that's the idea that was born, the Northern California Perspective, which is the first publication coming out of Amalgam, had that in mind. We wanted to have short fiction and poetry and creative nonfiction that really highlighted Northern California. And the model is to kind of go to new places and do this, in regionally specific areas. So either by state or in the larger states like here in California, you know, you'd have a Bay Area perspective and a Southern California perspective and an Inland Empire perspective, or whatever they would be named. But the idea was to help cultivate local talent and then teach them how to be successful at it. And a lot of that was born out of working in the industry, and a lot of that was, you know, born out of working at magazines and seeing how hard authors struggle. And not just that, how limited it feels to them. You know, publishing is this huge, huge world, but it's still kind of a closed sphere in a lot of ways. And I like to let people see that. So Amalgam was kind of a way to do that. So the consulting and publishing kind of became, you know, the same thing. But I'll help people. I'll design the book for them. I'll do the editing. I'll do the cover, and then I just give it to them. It's theirs. I don't own any of it or anything like that. But just to help them, you know, get on their feet and see, wow, this is something I can do. I can weather this and, you know, I can go after my dream. I just have to learn how to package it right. And I have to learn how to, you know, stay with it and be consistent and build those behaviors that let me be successful. I'm not getting in my own way. So Amalgam became this kind of thing for me that was a lot bigger than just the, you know, the collections that I would put out or the books I would help people put out. It was more, you know, this idea of, you know, what Amalgam means, which is, you know, several disparate pieces that come together to make a unique whole. So that's kind of what I was trying to do, and a bunch of different voices that create, you know, one identity.
Well, I want to give people a little, a couple of your websites here, because you have the danobryanproject.blogspot.com. That's where they can find out a lot about your works. They can find out about, you know, the book Bitten that we've talked about a little bit, that Northern California perspective. Then the other thing that they can go on is Amalgam Consulting. That's AmalgamConsulting.com. And that was kind of what we were just talking about, where people can find out, excuse me, like more information on that and everything that you have going on. Now,
yeah, I mean,
you're a good person to talk about, you know, with the publishing industry in general, is where do you see it going in 2014 and beyond?
You know, there's been a rallying cry somehow that print is dead or print is going to die, or that the big five or the big four, you know, depending on how you want to classify it, the major publishers are kind of on the out, and I don't see it that way. You know, I see it as, you know, maybe reading getting bigger than it has been in a long time because we have multiple media and because we have different ways to access it. I think you're going to see an increasing push in self-publishing simply because the platforms and the modules are there. There's always been bad books. Self-publishing obviously didn't bring that about. But I think things like nonfiction and poetry will always have a place in print. I think literary fiction will always have a place in print. People like the idea of sitting down with those kind of books. Commercial fiction, I think we're going to see, you know, an even bigger e-book explosion. I think we're going to see more and more and more digital books for speculative and commercial fiction. And I think we'll see a return to form at some point. Everything changes, everything evolves, that's just the way it is. I think we'll kind of work our way through and, you know, maturate in this, you know, digital publishing type process. I think we'll see a return to small publishing houses and community-oriented publishing houses. And then maybe a return to form even for the larger publishing houses, you know, when they catch up and they redefine their business model to take into account, you know, what self-publishing is doing and what it does for writers, and maybe offer them something that isn't available in self-publishing. And that's, to me, what's kind of missing right now. And anything you can do with a traditional publisher, you can do on your own. So the question becomes, why would you do that? Why would you put yourself through that process? Why not put your own book out, get it professionally edited, get it professionally designed, build some kind of platform, build some kind of readership, and then approach them and say, hey, I can bring this many readers with me. So it feels like for the big publishers to compete long-term and to stick around, they're going to have to offer something kind of unique as opposed to mutually overlapping types of services. But I think it's just going to get bigger, especially ebook-wise.
Yeah, I think ebook-wise, I think things will get bigger with that, and I kind of like it. I love ebooks. I've never shied away from telling anybody that I love ebooks. I like them better than print books because it's the same information, except I can put 1,000 of them on a little dinky tablet that sits in my hand, and I have to walk around with 1,000 of them. I can load as many free books as if I want to when I go to Japan, and I only have to carry a very little thing. Because now that airlines are charging you $50 for a flipping bag, why do I want to carry 7 books with me?
We're all walking libraries. I like them.
I mean, that's the thing, too, is like iPads and Kindles, those computers are more powerful. Your phone is a more powerful computer than when you were studying in elementary school or high school in those computers. They're more powerful than the way it was. So I think
there were floppy disks when there were floppy.
Yeah, I mean, I was original Apple on Pascal. I mean, and I had to play games that, you know, it was King's Quest and it was pick up the sword. Okay, put sword in, you know, right. Now your smartphone does so many more things. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you what, Dan, I mean, the things that are going on and the things that are happening, when you hear new authors and they come to you for advice and for help, like you do, and you try to help them through the process, what's one of the one things that you want to make sure that they understand when they walk away from the conversation with you? What's one of the number one or two or three points that you really try to drive home with them that you really want them to know?
And it is really two or three things. One of those is that you are capable of doing it. Any person is capable of putting out a book. But you really need to identify what it is you want to do. Do you want to have fame? Do you want to, you know, go through a legacy publisher? Do you just want people to read your book? Do you think you're going to make money? And to learn the business side of it, because that's what's really changed in the last 10 or 15 years, is the business sense and the business acumen your average writer has to have. They have to have some sense of treating their books and treating their brand like it was a small business. And if you don't know that going in, you'll certainly, it's a sledgehammer that's going to hit you in the face, you know, 6 months or a year down the line. If your book comes out, because you're going to realize, you know, no readers are coming to me. I have to get to them. How do I get to them? And the way to get to them is, you know, brand awareness and building your brand in some way. So those are really the three things that always kind of jump at me is, you know, learn to put that business hat on, learn what it means to run a small business in some way. But know that you can do it. It's not insurmountable. Take it one piece at a time. And really identify what it is you want from writing. I mean, are you doing it just for passion? Because if you're doing it just for passion, you know, pump out an e-book. Just do it and start a blog. And it just kind of give it away very inexpensively and build your readership. That's not a difficult thing to do, and it's certainly not a bad thing to do. If you just want just love of reading and love of having some kind of readership, if you want to treat it like a business, you have to learn how to treat it like a business.
Yeah, and that's the when you say treat it like a business, I think what that means is with any business, money has to be invested. One of the things
Absolutely.
That people can do money-wise is you can fly out to a conference like Thriller Fest where they have Craft Fest where you have 7 to 10 New York Times bestselling authors sitting in a room and they're telling you, this is how you do it, this is how we do it, this is how you write, this is how you create characters. And it's an investment that they need to do. Sure, I mean, if you don't live close to New York, you have to pay for flight, you got to pay for hotel, and it could be a couple thousand dollars. But if you start a business, think of a business you can start for under $5,000 and make a lot of money and be successful. I would have to say probably zero.
Had
to do that. But if you put $5,000 into your writing and honestly put it together, you will be successful and you'll make your money back. Now, you might not make a million, but you'll make your money back, and I think you'll feel very satisfied with that.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, $5,000 is probably that magic number in a way because you're probably going to pay $500 for editing and maybe $500 for design. You're going to want a website of some kind, and then you're going to have to do advertising, whether it's Facebook ads or Google ads or Yahoo ads, you know, or something you have to market in some way. But going to cons, honestly, is one of the best things you can do. It's what I always suggest. Whether it's genre-specific, whether it's a writer's conference, just go, just network. You know, that's really what becomes important because writers – don't realize that readers don't come to you. You have to go to them. And you have to figure out, like any business, where do the people that are going to purchase my product congregate, whether digitally or in person? And conventions are one of those, you know, nail on the head, absolutely go to them whenever you can. And there's always more of them than you think. I mean, there's the huge ones in L.A. and New York, obviously. But if you live on the West Coast, there's ones in Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, L.A., San Diego. Santa Cruz even has a few. Sacramento has a few. So there's always something to go to.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. Well, I'll tell you what, Dan. The book, again, is Bitten, and I know we spent a little bit of time with that at the beginning, but I want to make sure that we come back to people to let people know that the book is Bitten. It is an FBI thriller. It is set in Minnesota, rural Minnesota. There's a lot of stuff that goes on with it. You have a little bit of supernatural things that happen in there, but a police procedural mystery, and not to mention your consulting business, Amalgam Consulting. So you have a lot of things going on. And if there's anything that we can always do to help you with the magazine and radio show, you know, just simply ask us. Let us know.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to take part in any way I can. Of course.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Dan. Again, thanks so much for coming on. It's been a fascinating conversation. It's always great to be able to have somebody kind of, you know, behind the scenes who's done a couple different things, and it's just not writing, and it's always, you know, so it gives a different perspective.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, anyway, you have a good one, and we will see you soon, and have fun in Northern California, because it's a hell of a lot nicer up there than most of the country, but it's not as nice as Southern California, but that's okay. We won't hold that against you.
All right. Thanks again.
So, all right. Bye-bye, Dan. Have a good one. So again, everybody, that is author and publisher, consultant, Dan O'Brien. You can visit the Dan O'Brien Project amalgam.blogspot.com, and then again, Amalgam Consulting, A-M-A-L-G-A-M Consulting.com for more information there. We are going to be back here with our last guest of the day. Her name is Esther Luttrell, or maybe Luttrell. It could be Luttrell. I might mess that up. But she'll let me know when I get off. And we will be right back with that right after this. So welcome back, everybody, to a great show that we have had going on here. We have had three fantastic authors. We have had some different perspectives on a lot of great conversation going on, and it's going to continue here with our next guest. She is, she's a speaker, she's an author, so she's done a lot of things in the industry. So we're going to have a little bit of different perspective also on how things are going out there, and another just and how, you know, how authors can, you know, better themselves, how readers can find out more information. So her name is Esther Luttrell, and see, I got that right. And so, Esther, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
Fine, thank you. You know, it was funny during our preamble there before we were on the air. I thought we were on the air.
Oh, yeah. No,
okay.
No. That was just me just kind of, you know, getting the feel of what's going on and how everything's going on. So, like we said, you know, we talked a little bit off the air, and we were kind of trying to figure out what was maybe the best way to, you know, get going in this. But why don't we just go ahead and you kind of letting people know exactly, you know, who you are, the kind of things that you write, the kinds of things that you focus on when you, you know, when you're out there and you're speaking, what are people interested in? You just, you know, let's kind of start with that.
Okay, well, when I go out and speak, first of all, I have learned that if you sit at a table waiting for people to come to you in a bookstore, unless you've got an awful lot of friends who are going to buy some books they really don't even want anyway, but they want to support you, you're going to be very lonely. And so what I have found is that the key to selling books is to go out and speak. Speak to everybody who will let you talk to them, whether it's the Kiwanis, the Optimists, women's clubs, churches. I speak everywhere they leave a door open and I can slip in. When I do that, the books I have with me sell. When I sit at a table, they don't. And I think a lot of writers, especially as we were saying in the preamble, right now anybody can write. Anybody can publish. It's absolutely wide open. Comes, I think, in the writers who have such a story they want to tell. They get it done. They use CreateSpace, Author House. They use some source to self-publish, get it out there. Then they line up this signing, and nobody comes. Well, first of all, I think we've lost sight of what a book signing really is. Am I boring you, or shall I go on with that line? Well,
yeah.
I just see so many writers do this, and they get so frustrated, and they think they're no good because no one is coming up and clamoring to buy their book. You have to remember, book signing started because celebrities or well-known writers would actually be in a place where the public can come and see them, buy their favorite author, and get to say hello to them and actually get their autograph. That's a book signing. So when we're nobody and unknown and we set up a table, don't judge your worth or the worth of your writing by the amount of people who do or don't buy. The national average at a book signing is 3 books anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So stop and think why you want to have a book signing. Now, look at it another way. If you have an opportunity to go out and speak before groups and tell them about the passion of your writing, tell them why you write, and tell them, most of all, how it impacts their life, now you're going to sell your books. And once you get a following, then you can have those little book signings and somebody might show up. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, I think that you need to, if you're coming right out of the gate and the first thing you're going to do is have a book signing, you're right. No one's really going to know who you are, and you could just be wasting a lot of your time because you haven't, you know, you haven't been out there. You haven't talked to the people. You know, you haven't kind of made that social networking following. And, again, like we've talked about off the air with many different people, publishing now with the publishers not being able to control the supply of it, it's everywhere. And and so you got to kind of make your name for yourself and let everybody know a little bit about, like, you know, like, what do you write about? Like, when you're writing, like, what are your books? You know, what are the kind of the things that interest you? What are the stories you're trying to tell?
You know, I think, like most writers, people come to you and they say, will you write my story? you are not sitting there as a writer hoping somebody will give you a story. Writers that I know have so many stories flying around in their head, the challenge is to stay alive long enough to get them all written down.
That's for sure.
Isn't it? Do you write?
I do.
You have books out there?
And I write, you know, I write little things here and there, but I'm working on writing, you know, like a book and this and that, and it takes some time. And I always have a lot of ideas that pop into my head, and sometimes mm-hmm. things go, you know, back and forth different ways. But, yeah, I always write something.
So, you know, the idea is not to go find a story, but the idea is to plot it, write it, and then figure out who's going to read it and how are you going to reach the people that you want to know your story. My first novel, and I think my ex-husband may be listening right now, and his wife, who's just wonderful. In fact, I used her blurb about The Haunting of Lee Maxwell, a mystery I wrote. I use her blurb on the back of cover of my book. So,
nice.
Casey's listening. Please remember, people say, are your stories true? You know, our stories are true. We can't write about them if we haven't experienced at least a portion of what we write about. We wouldn't have an insight into it. So when I say I wrote my first book because my husband left me and I was driving around trying to think how to kill him, that's true. And then
it's good that you're honest, though.
Well, the more I thought about it, after I was driving around, I thought, well, if I do it that way, they'll think his mama did it. If I do it that way, they'll think his ex-wife did it. And by the time I thought it all through, I went, I think I have a story. And I hurried back to my house, and I wrote Murder in the Movies in about 3 weeks. Now, he didn't do all those horrible things I said he did, but I had a lot of fun murdering his rear end. It's a really good therapy, yeah. And the first publisher that read it took it. And, in fact, it's coming out now. It's being re-released. Wild Rose Press is coming out with it. I don't know when the release date is. I'm just signing the contract now. But that's a good way to get started. Use your own personal experiences and then put a what-if spin on it. What if this really happened, but what if this had happened? Now you've got a story. Now, who's going to read it? How are you going to sell it? How are you going to market it? How are you going to reach the people you want to reach? That's the real challenge.
And how have you been able to overcome that? What's one of the one things that you've been able to do to overcome those challenges?
Well, I'm being redundant, but go out and get speaking engagements. Someone said the other day.
Let's say someone writes a medical thriller. And, mm-hmm. you know, and so they're a doctor or whatnot, and they know the medical thrill. Would they want to go look out, you know, places or book clubs or things that, of course, are, you know, interested in those types of things? But when they're talking about speaking engagements, not just conferences of mystery and thriller conferences, but you're saying going out and finding people that are interested in medicine and that maybe would be interested in something that, you know, fictionalizes it in this kind of way?
Well, I think if you wrote a medical thriller, if I wrote a medical thriller, I'd be trying to speak at doctors' conventions. I would be trying to speak to various groups that, and as a matter of fact, let's take a good example. I wrote a book called Between Heaven and Earth, Proof Beyond Doubt that Life and Love Are Eternal. And that was based on my own spiritual journey after the death of my son. But it's not a story about me, and it's really not a story about him. It's a story about all I've learned about life after death once that happened. Well, where did I speak? I spoke to the Edgar Casey Group in Virginia Beach at their headquarters. I spoke to Midland Hospice just recently. These are people who are at different ends of being interested in life after death, but they are both interested. And actually, anybody who's lost a loved one, whose heart has been broken from a terrible loss, is going to want to hear how other people cope with it and who does have an insight, or at least listen to whether or not they have an insight, on life after death. So you're talking to people who would have an interest in your subject.
Yeah, and that's a very important piece that a lot of people might not realize, is if you go out even just the internet and you're searching places to find, you'll find conventions probably locally, and maybe it's only 30 people, maybe it's only, you know, 20 people, but those are 20 people that you probably would have never connected with, and those 20 people can turn into 40, and then those 40 can turn into 80, and then those 80, 160, and then, of course, so on and so on and so on, and that's kind mm-hmm. of the way for a young author to be able to start and gain a following, gain some mm-hmm. name recognition, and, of course, always keep writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm just really, really big on that as a venue for getting out in front of people. I will be giving a class, if anybody's in the St. Louis area, on, I think it's April the 12th. I actually have it written down, so I'll be sure and be there on the right date. Let's see. April 12th, yes. On the Merrimack campus in St. Louis, giving a class with an author, Joe Heaston, who has written something like 23 mysteries with a publisher. Yes. We just recently ran a test between ourselves and tried Create Space as a test to see where you're better off. Are you better off with a traditional publisher? As I say, I just signed with one. All of my books have been with traditional publishers. Now we're testing Create Space, and whoa, what an eye opener! Anyway, we'll be talking about publishing
in a positive way or a negative way.
Whatever you make of it, because facts are facts. You know, do you see them negatively or positively? Let me tell you this. I won't even say the name of my publisher for this particular book, but their deal is 7% of the retail price for the author. And they tie up film rights, email, e-books, audiobooks, print, etc. So
everything.
That's 7% across the board. That's a very, very, not the best deal a writer can make. But this particular publisher has an outstanding reputation. Now, on CreateSpace, you're going to get from 35 to 70% of your retail cost. But if you're only going to reach a handful of people, and the publisher has a marketing arm that's going to reach many, many more, your 7% could possibly amount to more than your 70%. You see what I'm saying?
True. The only one thing that I say as a devil's advocate is this, is that because we work mm-hmm. with a lot of publishers, and basically 4 weeks after the book is out, they go away, and now you're still on your own.
This is one thing I talk about all the time. Please don't think just because you attract a traditional publisher that you're off the marketing hook. You aren't.
Right.
Those days are past.
I tell people as soon as you sign with a publisher and you put your name on the contract, that's no longer the end. That's just the beginning. Because now you have to really work harder at marketing yourself and getting out there than you ever did writing the book. And you'll see, and I tell people, writing is a lot easier than marketing. And you'll see it when you go out there.
Oh gosh, yes. Let me tell you the truth. I hate marketing. I hate it with a passion. I have even set up a plan. I make notes to myself all over the place. All right, we're going to get up like normal people at 8 o'clock in the morning. We're going to be at our desk. We're going to play like this is a real company, and I'm chairman of the board and secretary and janitor. I have to be at my desk at 8 o'clock. I will market until noon when I will stop for a normal lunch, and then the rest of the day I will spend writing. Well, I get up, I have an idea. Okay, I'll mark it in a minute. First, let me write this idea down. Next thing I know, it's 4 o'clock and I haven't had breakfast. I have a difficult time, and I think most writers do, of scheduling this business side of what we must do if we intend to earn a living off of our writing.
Absolutely. I mean, that is... I couldn't have put it any better. And that's the one thing as far as when the marketing and what you have to do is you have to phone this. This has to be a business. And that's the same thing that Dan and I talked about. And that's what we try to, you know, let people know. This writing is a business. If you want it as a hobby, you can do it as a hobby. But you know, write it for yourself, sell it to your family, give it out as Christmas presents, that's fine,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to make money, you want it to be a career, it's a business like anything else. You have to invest yourself. People don't realize this. If you're a lawyer and you're starting your own business, you remember you've already invested $200,000+ into your business by having to go to school, pay your books, go to your, you know, your universities, your degrees and everything else. Now you have to actually go out and get clients. Well, now you have to spend more money at doing that to get that back. Well, writing is no different. It's just a different avenue.
Point is so well taken. Did I interrupt you? I'm sorry.
No.
No.
But I do want to remind
I'm really bad about that.
I do want to remind people that we are speaking with Esther Luttrell, and it's estherluttrell.com, and that's estherluttrell.com is your website. And so now, go right ahead.
I was going to say, your points are just so beautifully taken. You're absolutely right. You know, for many years, I just wrote screenplays until I finally went and murdered my ex-husband's rear end. Before that, it was all screenplays. I was with MGM and CBS, and I just spent years writing screenplays. When my son died, he was an aspiring screenplay writer, and I wanted to do something with his insurance money that would honor him. And so my ex-boss, I was production coordinator on the TV show Chips, if you remember that.
I know Chips in Southern California, yeah.
You know that?
I'm not going to hum the whole thing, but I know Chips.
I see Eric's hair flying in the wind now as he's riding that motorcycle, which wasn't him, by the way, on the motorcycle, but his wonderful
right.
double. Anyway, gosh, where was I? We were talking about, now I lost my train of thought.
Your point was well taken.
Oh, businesses. Okay. So I went out across the country with my boss, who had been the producer on Chips, Don Gold, and he went on to, for the next 7 years, produce Miami Vice and then Diagnosis Murder. And then when Dean died, I called him and I said, I'm going to go across the country giving screenwriting workshops. Do you want to go with me? Because I didn't think anybody'd come see me. Who am I? But I figured Don Gold had enough credits, they'd come see him. So he was my insurance. And we went out for 8 years. We gave for 40 workshops across the country. Now, people would come to me, and they would want me to edit their screenplays. I figured, well, gee, Moni, if I'm going to do this, I hate to do it, but I've got to charge. And people would get upset that I would want to charge. And I would say to them, wait a minute. You are wanting to enter one of the most competitive fields, maybe in the entire world, very competitive, and you're not willing to spend $450 to have your script edited line by line and give you free counseling for the rest of your life? What business can you go into and actually hang a shingle out and say the doors are open now for $450? A doctor is a professional. A dentist is a professional. Teaching is professional. These people all had to pay a tremendous amount of money for the education to become proficient enough to earn a living. And you don't want to spend $450? Now, having said that, one of the biggest warnings is, Lord sakes, new writers, be careful. For everything you need done and everything you want to do, there is a con artist out there who's figured how to get your dollar, and you will get nothing in return that you can use. That's one of the scariest things to me. They charge a lot of money to take your manuscript and format it for you into an ebook. You know what I do to format my manuscripts into an ebook? I hit one key on my computer and it's done. One key. And yet they're going to charge you $300-$500 to format your script. It's so sad. There's not one place we can go for good and correct information and then follow the dot as if you're in college. You say, okay, I will get a degree in this, and then I will be able to step outside and go get a job in that field. There's nothing like that for the writer.
That's true. I mean, there it is. I mean, there's a lot of place, a lot of things to go, and there's a lot of things to sift through. And I think that that makes it, you know, very very difficult and sometimes frustrating, very frustrating for, you
yeah.
know, for an author.
What are the sources? What are they? You know, I have to tell you, I love your magazine. I just love your magazine. And let's do all we can to market it. Want to?
Yeah, I'm all for it. I'm doing it right now. You know, every time we speak, wherever we go, I'm always trying to look at, trying to see how many more people we get to read it, because we're just trying to bring more people to the genre in order to find authors. Because where else? It's there's so many places to go to find new authors when you want to read books, and
yeah.
that's what we're trying to do. Is in the genre, where can you go? Well, you know, we have a lot of debut authors. I mean, we know we've talked with, you know, T.J. O'Connor, Libby Hellman, and, you know, on the show.
I know.
There's not a lot of people might not know about, but that's what we're trying to do, is to bring more and more and more authors to people, and that's just, and that's what we try to do. We're just trying to help the genre.
Well, and see, you're being so clever about it. Now, for instance, I sent out, oh, I don't know, maybe 500 or 1,000 emails inviting people to listen. Every time you have an author on, you have a whole new pool of people, of potential readers to a suspense magazine. And that's
right.
where people have to get clever like you. You've got to find something, some way to not just reach the people you know about, but people that other people know about. And that's a real trick. Gee, here you're giving me the
yeah.
opportunity to talk about my mysteries, and I'm not even talking
Absolutely.
About it. I'm talking about marketing. But I appreciate the chance to talk about it. We know I wrote Murder in the Movies to murder my ex-husband's rear end, and
yeah.
that sort of opened the door. Later, I was in Hawaii on business, and an attorney said to me, "So where do you live?" And I said, "Well, actually, I'm living in Topeka right now." He said, "Topeka." Yeah. I said, "You know Topeka?" He said, "I know you all are really good at picketing." And I suppose you know what that reference is to. And I thought on the plane coming back, that's not fair. I'm going to write a book, a mystery. I'm going to set it in Topeka, and it's going to be a Valentine to Topeka. People are going to know more about the place than that. So I wrote Invitation to a Murder. Well, at that time, I was with a publisher, L&L Dreamspell, and the editor suggested I start a series called State of the Murder Mysteries. So Invitation to a Murder, even though it's set in Topeka, the actual murder takes place in Westport in Kansas City. So that's the first Missouri State of the Murder Mystery. And then the next one coming up is Murder on Burnett's Mound, which is a Kansas State of the Murder Mystery, followed by Murder on Mingus Mountain, which is an Arizona State of the Murder Mystery. If I live long enough, I'll get all the states covered.
That's true. You could do a murder by state.
I am.
I mean, Sue Grafton does the murder by alphabet. You could do murder by state.
Absolutely. And it's been so much fun so far. Just the research on the history of the places, because we work that into the story, of course. There's no point in doing it if you don't have real history in there and a sense of being there. So that's fun. Then I had this idea 4 years ago. I wanted to write something called dime store novels. And what it would be short stories. And it would never sell for more than 99 cents. I had the idea for 4 years. I never got around to it. About 2 weeks ago, I said, "This is absurd. Why have an idea if you don't do it?" So my first dime store novel is actually out on Kindle right now, and it's called A Stranger in the House. It's dime store novel number one. Dime store novel number two will be up on Monday on Kindle, and it's called Yellow, Green, Blue, and Dead. And it's set in Topeka's art district of Noho, Noto, it's called. So that's a new series, and that's fun. And The Haunting of Lee Maxwell is out there, so somebody please read that, L-E-I-G-H, Lee. Okay,
yep.
I got my mystery plugs in.
Well, I'll tell you what, Esther, I mean, we are running up against the clock, and it has been fascinating to be able to sit and talk with you, and again, talk with someone who else has been involved a lot in the genre and everything else that you've been able to accomplish and do. It's great information. I just hope that a lot of authors and fans, of course, you know, take notice about how things, you know, how things are and what they can do to be better.
And also explore the possibility of how important is social networking to get things sold. I'm still asking that question. Is Twitter a part of the sales process? Is Facebook really helpful?
Right.
Lots and lots of different. I'd love to hear you do a whole show on that because there are so many different views on it.
Yeah, there are. All right. Well, I'll tell you, Esther, we will talk with you later and stay in touch. And, again, thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you for letting me. I appreciate it so much. And good luck with your magazine. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you and enjoy.
Thank you. Bye, Ann.
Bye. So, again, everybody, that was author, marketing, speaker, Esther Latrall. And you can find out a lot more information by going to estherlatrall.com. I will say, do not forget all the crime and science radio that we have going on here. You want to make sure that you go to Suspense Magazine, click on the crime and science radio, I think go to radio link, go to see everything that they have going on because there's some fascinating shows that they have going on and some fascinating shows coming up with the guest list that I see coming on. You ain't going to want to miss it. So make sure you check out all the crime and science radio. And all you have to do is just go to blogtalkradio.com/suspensemagazine. You see all of the episodes there. They'll say Crime and Science Radio, and you'll be able to check them all out. Coming up, our next show for Suspense Radio is going to be on February the 8th. We are going to have number one New York Times bestseller Robin Cook on that show, along with Sarah Penborough, and, of course, our fan favorite and good friend John Land will be back on talking about his latest adventures and his book. So we want to thank you all for joining us again today. Check out also Stranger Than Fiction. We're going to have that next episode up on Friday. And, of course, next Saturday you'll have another Crime and Science Radio. So until then, everybody, we want to thank you all. SuspenseMagazine.com and get the magazine and anything else you got. Email us, editor@SuspenseMagazine.com. So until February 8th, I will talk with you all then. Goodbye.